How can a high-crime community turn around, and what does it take to make that happen? In our last episode, we heard Pastor Chris Harris of the Greater Bronzeville area of South Chicago talking about his TURN model, T-U-R-N, the Urban Resilience Network, for both turning around high-crime communities and preventing communities from becoming high-crime communities. In this episode, we learn about a key component of that model through a conversation with Deanna Perez, the clinical director of the Behavioral Health Unit of Bright Star Community Outreach, through which Pastor Harris and his team turn vision into reality. This is Justice Voices, eye-opening stories that need to be told, voices that need to be heard regarding justice, healing, and safer communities. Welcome. Our guest today is Deanna Perez. Deanna, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Deanna, you are a licensed clinical professional counselor.
Correct.
You are the clinical director of the Behavioral Health Department of Bright Star Community Outreach, or BSCO.
Absolutely.
You have a master's in clinical psychology.
Yes, I do.
And that was from the Chicago School.
Correct.
Now, in your LinkedIn profile, it says you, prior to that, got a master's degree in criminal justice.
Correct.
Now, that's interesting that you would get two master's degree in that progression. What led you after, well, first of all, what led you to seek a master's degree in criminal justice?
Full transparency, I wanted to be a profiler. And I was looking to apply to the FBI for the behavioral analyst position that they have. And as I grew in both age and maturity, I decided that I did not want to move every couple of years in order to continue in my path. So when I went back and got my second master's, I decided that I really enjoyed the one-on-one therapy style that I learned, and I continued in that. But I still utilize my criminal justice master's. I think restorative justice and just acknowledgement and understanding of the criminal justice system, as well as the criminal justice system being the largest employer of mental health people, I like having that as a context to my engagement.
It seems to me, in the path that you've chosen, that that is a really good combination of degrees, academic background, qualifications. You mentioned restorative justice. Now, those who have listened to this podcast have heard me say many times that one of the most fundamental things we need to do in improving our criminal justice system is to move from a punishment paradigm of justice, punishing the perpetrator of harm, to a problem-solving paradigm of justice. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean problem-solving for resolving, to the extent that it's possible, the problem that led to the perpetrator of harm committing those criminal acts, but also those criminal acts created a problem, harm for victims. Mm-hmm. And so it's not justice if it's not justice for the victims.
Correct.
Not just for society in punishing a perpetrator of harm. And so restorative justice is, first of all, a victim-oriented, harm-healing paradigm of justice, but also looks at the harm that has been caused and seeking to heal the harm of the perpetrator of the act, which so often leads them to commit the act in the first place. If you don't address the underlying cause, then you have a lingering problem that may lead to continued acts of perpetration of harm. And as sometimes is said, hurt people hurt people.
Absolutely.
Now, this is important for our discussion today, because what we're going to be talking about is healing harm, primarily. What a profession to be involved in.
Yes, absolutely. Going a couple steps back, with regards to restorative justice, I think that, as you pointed out, it is a two-prong approach, and that is so novel to our society that there's not just harm for the victim and the victim's family. There's also harm that may have caused and continues in the perpetrator and the perpetrator's family. And wouldn't it be interesting if we tried something new and we try to, like you said, heal harm, which, as I pointed out, is on both sides. And so being able to heal that harm by means that I'm sure we'll discuss, it actually leads us to being a stronger, safer society overall. And if you want to look at it this way, costs less in the long run, because hopefully that means that perpetrator will not perpetrate again. And hopefully that means that the harm that caused that perpetrator to do so is closer to getting fixed, so their family is less likely to perpetrate in the future. And so I find that when we have conversations about turning theory into function, a lot of people struggle with why that's so proactive. I love being proactive as much as possible, but the bottom line in trying to get projects and agencies paid for is money. And I think that's where people like me and the providers, we don't like to think about that. We want to help people. Well, we help people by making sure that others who fund us recognize that if we do it this way and we are more proactive, in the long run, we spend less money. We spend less money on emergency services. We spend less money in prisons. We spend less money on services that are being provided to victims because there will be less victims. I hope that makes sense.
To me, it makes enormous sense. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Some people who are listening may or may not know, after I retired as a career federal prosecutor, I was recruited to work in the Illinois governor's office, the previous administration, where I was the director of public safety policy. Mm. In that capacity, I was looking at the way things should be, not just trying to make the system work mm-hmm. as best I could in my role as a prosecutor, but stepping back and saying, what should the system be? Well, I can tell you that from my experience as a prosecutor, the criminal justice system is inherently reactive. It's activated when a crime is committed. It's not, I tried to be as proactive as possible in trying to intervene with a lower level criminal prosecution before more serious acts of violence or larger amounts of drugs were distributed or whatever it might be.
Right, that makes sense.
You try to be proactive, but you still have to have an underlying crime to
Correct.
Trigger the system, right?
Right.
It's inherently reactive. Okay, so if you're going to, we hear it's commonly said, we want to, and politicians, every politician says, I want to be tough on crime.
Mm-hmm.
No politician says we should be weak on crime. And what does it usually translate into? Well, it translates into more punishment for the perpetrators of crime. Well, that's after the crime has happened.
Right. Wouldn't it be interesting if it actually translated into more services so that those crimes never exist? So, and by services, I mean those therapeutic interventions, social emotional learning in schools, providing systemic education to everyone about the need for seeking help when they need help. It just would be a better world, I think.
It would be a much better world, and it would be better, not only a safer world, mm-hmm. but you also raised the point of cost benefit, the cost efficiency or cost effectiveness
right.
of preventing crime. The cost of incarcerating people is huge.
So huge.
And when you have a system that almost encourages recidivism, meaning recycling mm-hmm. people back into prison, that cost is huge. We've covered that. I don't remember the figure right offhand, but it's mind-boggling. There's an agency in Illinois that calculated the real cost of recidivism per person, and it's huge. Now, if those resources were spent on something research has shown that the most cost-effective measure or service that could be rendered to people who are in prison to prevent recidivism, recycling back,
right,
is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Fair.
Okay. Now, basically, you have to get your head straight before you can get your life straight. But then when you have a system in which people get out of prison and they face some forms of barriers to licensure or professions or other sorts of, or just plain, we don't hire felons.
Correct.
You went to prison for whatever reason. If there are fewer alternatives to crime when they get out of prison than before they went to prison, we shouldn't be surprised that they return to crime.
No, we shouldn't.
At huge cost to taxpayers. So getting tough on crime? Okay. To do something, as they say, to keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Is the definition of insanity.
There yes. you go. Well, there we go. And so that's really why we have this podcast, is because of this perspective that I gained over the course of my career, over the course of my work in the governor's office, which along the way led me to meet Pastor Chris Harris of Bright Star Church. And Pastor Harris introduced me to the TURN model, which is embodied in the TURN Center, which is stands for TURN, T-U-R-N, mm-hmm. the Urban Resilience Network.
Correct.
And you work for, we are sitting in the TURN Center.
We are absolutely sitting in the TURN Center, yes. And the whole point behind the TURN Center is to invite and bring in as many wraparound services as possible. So this could be a theoretical one-stop shop. If somebody comes in and they need mental health services, they can receive those from the behavioral health department. If they need workforce development, they can receive them from our workforce development department. But then we also will have friends that are in the process of coming into the TURN Center who can support the same work or similar work so that we can help more people and make sure that they have equity in those services. I think a lot of people may be surprised that there's so many participants out there that don't know that these services exist, that these services are free of cost or very low cost, and that they're here for you. That's one thing. The other thing, they don't seek them. They don't seek them because they don't want to be labeled. And there's this still this huge stigma towards not only mental health and behavioral health, but just asking for help. Because as we were talking earlier, the need for respect and I can stand on my own. Yes, I appreciate that, and I want you to be able to stand on your own. I don't expect you to be in these services for the rest of your life, but there's the idea of teaching a person to fish, and that's what we do here. We're trying to teach people, more people, as many people, no matter your race, creed, color, country of origin, to fish so that we as a society can be stronger.
That is important from a crime prevention perspective, as well as reacting to crime when it happens, but from the perspective of preventing crime, because in my observation, most crime, not all crime, some crime is spontaneous. Mm-hmm. Something happens and it's unlikely to ever recur again. But particularly with repeat offenders, this is an adaptive behavior to circumstances somebody is in, perfectly rational, actually. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's some genetic defect in high crime communities that caused the residents of those communities, particularly the men, the young men, to engage in criminal activity. It's an adaptive behavior. It's a logical adaptive behavior.
Yeah.
As we said, as I commented before we started recording here, if you live in a neighborhood where the biggest or and maybe the only really thriving business is the crime business, well, what business do you expect young men right. and aspiring young women even to be going into?
Well, I would say it's a learned response to trying to get their needs met. There's no judgment in that. There's no anything in it. It's just a phrase. This is something that people have learned in order to get their needs met. And we were talking previously, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I understand that if people don't have food, if people don't have clothes, if they don't have the things that they need to get the respect that they feel that they deserve, they're going to react. It's natural to do so. And it is a learned response. And there are some neighborhoods, especially in this city, where there really is no other alternative.
What impresses me, or one of the things that impresses me about the Bright Star approach, and is the idea that if you want to change behavior in a community, change the community, mm-hmm. change the environment in the community. If there are very few alternatives to crime as a means of thriving and progressing and gaining respect in a community, people will turn to that. If there are alternatives to crime, to both thrive economically or get by even economically, and to gain respect, community respect, well, then people will be more likely to turn to that. And if a community will not tolerate criminal activity, mm-hmm. it's very unlikely that the criminal activity is going to thrive there.
Correct.
So change the crime rate by changing the community, the environment.
Change the mindset, absolutely.
Change the underlying environment. And one of the things that is a theme that developed in the interviews that I've done, the conversations I've had as part of this podcast in the past, a theme that has developed is that the role of trauma as both a driver of crime, crime as a reaction to trauma, particularly chronic trauma experienced in early years, and trauma in the form of violence, be it domestic violence, violence experienced at school, on the way to school, on the way home from school, mm-hmm. violence in the community, violence to friends, violence to loved ones, violence to self. This chronic exposure to violence breeds violence.
Not only that, there's the concept that if you are in that type of environment for prolonged periods of time, you are never out of the flight or fight response, flight, fight, or freeze. So imagine a young person growing up in that type of environment, and they're never actually out of flight or fight. And that changes you. That changes biologically the levels of cortisol, the hormone that is secreted during that, but it also changes you psychologically because you're always being hypervigilant. You're always looking behind your back and wondering what could happen. You're anticipating bad instead of wanting good. And it takes up so much of your mind space that it is only natural, as you've put it, that people seek different ways to get out of that. Another point there that I wanted to make, trauma is so insidious. And one of the reasons that it is that is because it doesn't really breed a lot of criteria. You don't actually meet full criteria for PTSD or trauma until your body feels safe. And I've seen it so many times. I've worked with kids who have crossed the border without their families. I've worked with gang members. I've worked with sexual assault victims. And I've worked with people who have experienced abuse and neglect. They continue to be in flight or fight. And so they don't even recognize that they don't have that full criteria until they are safe. And then it's almost like your body tells you, okay, now that you're safe, all these symptoms start. And that's something that is, I don't think, talked about enough, because people anticipate, oh, now that you're safe, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. So now that you're out of this situation, you'll be fine. It actually needs to be a complete reset of mindset, and it needs to be a complete reset and understanding of trauma so that people know how to protect themselves and how to create coping skills to manage it. Because it's really not, you're going to see symptoms right away, yes, but you're not going to see the full breadth of symptoms until you're back home, until you're safe, or until you're in a different environment where you would perceivably, from an outsider's perspective, be okay. But that's when it really starts to hurt.
Well, one of the circumstances, the context in which people understand post-traumatic stress syndrome, it's post-trauma, mm-hmm. as you were saying. Mm-hmm. It's not during the trauma, mm-hmm. when the part of your brain, the fight, flight, freeze part mm-hmm. of your brain is in full operation. It leaves a mark.
Absolutely.
And not only, one of the things that I really, and I'm surprised that I hadn't heard of, it was actually after I had left my career as a federal prosecutor and was working in the governor's office, I attended a conference of statewide Illinois conference of problem-solving courts.
Hmm.
Most people don't know there are problem-solving courts.
No, not at all.
But there are. And they deal with behavioral health issues, drug addiction, things of that sort, the need for cognitive behavioral therapy. But also, one of the problem-solving courts is veterans courts.
Mm.
And, of course, post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, is something that is experienced by many combat veterans who have been in horrendously traumatizing circumstances. And it leaves a mark. What I learned at that conference was it's not just a psychological mark.
Mm-hmm.
It's a physical mark on the brain that shows up in brain scans.
Yeah.
There are parts, the brain has changed. The person's perceptions of reality mm-hmm. have changed. Their reaction to stimuli changes. And many of those changes lead to self-destructive or antisocial behavior, whether it be drug use or things of that sort, self-medication, so to speak, mm-hmm. but also can become very volatile and react violently to things that most people would not, and that person would not have responded in that way to before that trauma, particularly chronic trauma. Now, mm-hmm. here comes Pastor Chris Harris. He, mm-hmm. back in 2013, I think it was, he made a trip to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He met with people from a program there, Natal, N-A-T-A-L, because the initials, the acronym is in Hebrew. I won't repeat that. I wouldn't understand it anyway, but Natal. And they were an organization, as he explained it to me,
mm-hmm.
back in, I think it was 2018 when he and I first met. This was an organization that was helping people deal with and treating trauma in victims of terrorist attacks.
Correct.
And he invited them to come here to Bronzeville and teach staff and community members these mm-hmm. principles of dealing with trauma, help people cope with trauma, heal from trauma, and started extending those services
mm-hmm.
through the TURN program. And as a result, or as an objective, would be to try to prevent crime by heading it off at the pass. If you have a child in school and teachers have identified behavior, they're acting out,
mm-hmm.
and instead of saying punishment model, this kid needs an attitude adjustment. And instead, trauma-informed response, these are some of the first signs of a process of violentization,
mm-hmm.
and we need to nip this in the bud by providing these services up front. If you can do that, then you prevent crime. But then you also have the people who committed the crime, the victims of crime, all these people. This is a common need for trauma-informed care along this whole continuum.
Absolutely.
So can you talk to that?
Absolutely. So one key part of the Natal model that I want to make sure we discuss is one of the reasons that I joined this team, because I thought it was such a appropriate, and I couldn't believe that we hadn't thought of it before, response. So many people may or may not know, people of color don't seek mental health services for a variety of reasons, mostly stigma. They don't want to be considered crazy. And so very few will come to somebody like me, a licensed clinician. They will much more likely speak to their priest or pastor. And that would be their starting point. And the Natal model has room for that, in fact. And so we not only trained staff and advocates, we also trained pastors to make sure that if that was your starting point, so it's very participant forward, meaning we try and meet people where they are. And if they want to speak to a pastor first before they are assessed that maybe they need a little bit higher level of care, then we have that ability. And it is much more welcoming in my mind. And it acknowledges that everybody starts their path at a different point. And sometimes that means I need to talk to somebody who is a little bit more spiritual. And then all of our, we do have a number of pastors on staff. All of them are trained in our, we have a 12-month training schedule. Everyone is trained in trauma-informed care. We're trained in a variety of strengths-based focused engagement and assessing. I'm not going to go through all of our 12 trainings, but as a result, they know when it's become clear that they may need to go on and work with somebody who is more clinical. But at that point, we have the relationship and we can tell the participant, you now know, we know you're not crazy. We know that you just need a little bit of extra care, and that's okay. And that's such a more appropriate handoff than just throwing them into a clinical caseload, in my opinion. And so that's one of the nicest things that I enjoy about Natal, is it's very focused on the participant in that way. And because people of color struggle with understanding that behavioral health is part of physical health, that it's a continuum, it's a mind-body connection. And if your mind is broken or hurting, your body can break and hurt, or vice versa. And so just trying to get that information to people of color to let them know that it's okay to ask for help, that we have a variety of different types of staff. And if one does not work for you, we can find somebody else that will work for you. So very strengths-based and very participant-focused in that sense.
Are there any gender differences in the willingness of people, whether it be people of color, people in Bronzeville, or anywhere else in the course of your studies, your professional mm-hmm. studies, to seek professional help of the sort that you're talking about? Men versus women.
I've been placed in situations where it's been pretty equal for me. And I know we're not supposed to say this, but everybody has a favorite population that they like to work with. As a clinician, my favorite population is angry teenagers. I love angry teenagers. They're like M&Ms, that hard candy shell, and inside is that gooey chocolate. And they're just looking for family. They're looking for care. They're looking for that one adult that genuinely cares about them and their success. And unfortunately, in so many families, they don't receive that. But for me personally, no, I have not seen it be more male or female. I have seen it be more about what is normalized for you. And so generally speaking, in white society, it's very normal at this point. Maybe it's not. It's my perception. But it's more generalized that, oh, yeah, I have a therapist. I talk to a therapist. And you'll even go out for a cocktail with your friends and you'll say, oh, yeah, I saw my therapist yesterday. But in Hispanic culture or in other people of color cultures, that's not as normalized. And there's still the stigma of, oh, I can't talk about this because then people will perceive me in a way that I don't want. To your point, a lack of respect. They will feel less respect. And if that's what you're working towards, you're obviously not going to put yourself in a position to be more vulnerable.
It's kind of interesting. If somebody were to have heart problems, for example, or a bleeding ulcer, mm-hmm. and they failed to go to the emergency room or to their physician, a physician, or seek medical attention, people would look at them and say, there's something wrong with your thought processes.
Right.
I mean, what's defective is your response to this health issue. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to dealing with trauma or the sorts of things we're talking about here, it's interesting that it's almost the reverse. But if people grasp the idea that the brain is an organ like the heart,
exactly,
or the stomach, and there are certain things that happen that impact the brain and the way the brain processes information, perceives reality, there needs to be a health response. You can't punish your way to mental health.
No, you have to identify it and recognize it. And like I said, mental health is health. It's in the name. Mental health is part of your physical health. There, there is that connection. And actually, as a trained clinician, there's plenty of classes that you take where while assessing somebody who's new to you, somebody who's in front of you, you actually begin sometimes by asking them, you know, where does it hurt? Oh, my stomach feels very upset, or my hands start to sweat, or I just break into tears. And so it's so much easier for us as humans and less vulnerable to tell people there's something physically wrong with me. You know, it's my stomach, or it's my back. And really what's happening is overwhelming levels of stress, or overwhelming feelings of sadness, or some type of mood dysregulation that we just don't want to name. And there's some people in our society that feel more confident in naming them. And then there's others who still feel less confident. And I think the equitable thing to do is to provide more information and to try and encourage that destigmatization as much as possible, so that we can help ourselves, so that we can learn that the mind-body connection exists, and that mental health is physical health.
I mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy earlier. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is going to know what cognitive behavioral therapy is. I suspect most of the people who are listening do not know what it is, what I was referring to. And yet, I would venture to say that we could all benefit from cognitive behavioral therapy to one degree mm-hmm. or another. But particularly at-risk communities, traumatized communities, I mentioned, you know, the incarcerated community, people who have gotten out of incarceration, the returning citizens, people who are in an environment in which they feel they need to turn to violence to survive, as there's a guest in a former episode, a couple of episodes, Michael Tafoya, who made the comment, he came from a good family, straight A student, but he was getting shot at a lot in his community in Little Village, another neighborhood, predominantly Hispanic neighborhood of Chicago. And he made the conscious decision, I need to become what I feared. Mm-hmm. I need to become what I feared. And he became the most feared gang member in his neighborhood, as a form of self-preservation and protecting his family, and ultimately went to prison for murder is a predictable consequence of all this. Okay, well, all this is happening. How do you intervene? How do you step in to change that so you prevent that murder? Well, one of the ways to do that is, and it's happening with some programs here in Chicago, where there's proactive intervention approaching the person, not after they get involved in violence, but before they get involved in violence. In fact, if you can identify the people most likely to be victims of gun violence, mm-hmm. you also, those same people are highly likely, not all of them, but there's a high correlation between that and people who are most likely to be perpetrators of violence. So if you can intervene with them as people who are victims of violence, you prevent them from turning to violence. Well, this is a process of rethinking mm-hmm. how you respond to things. And so in that and in other areas, people that live in a law-abiding life in a high-crime community, cognitive behavioral therapy is important. Can you just educate our listeners as to what cognitive behavioral therapy is?
So I think without turning this into a full class on CBT, what the general public would benefit from is the idea of the cognitive behavioral triangle. So in the theory, it discusses that there is a connection between thought, emotion, and behavior. And I kind of spoke to it when assessing, it's so much easier for people to identify their behaviors, such as acting out, such as crime, such as crying, all those behaviors. And then you work backwards. So behaviors beget from emotions. What are the emotions? And so really just focusing on helping them identify, what are those emotions? Are they anger? Are they sadness? Are they feelings of being distraught or shamed or disrespected? And is that where it's coming from? And then it all leads back to those underlying thoughts or schema that we all have. In your example of your previous interviewee, his underlying thought was, I'm going to become the thing that I most fear. That thought became pervasive for him. And so all of his emotions and his behaviors then stemmed from that thought. So in CBT, if I were his therapist, we would work on identifying that thought and then creating a healthier one, a healthier concept for him, something that would actually create healthier emotions and healthier behaviors so that he would not face the logical consequences that he did ultimately face.
You know, the Michael Tafoya story is tragic as it relates to the person that who died and the other person who was shot, and as to Michael going to prison for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. But it has a happier ending because in prison, Michael became involved in a program run by the University of Illinois in the Danville Correctional Center, a program, educational program, college classes that were offered to help people advance toward degrees. And these are real college classes. Mm-hmm. And he became treated as a scholar, not a criminal, and not as a target of crime. And this changed the way he thought. And it's interesting listening to him describe the impact of being treated in this way. And now, Michael Tafoya, when I met him, he hadn't been out of prison too very long, but I met him at Adler University, was introduced to him, and he's one of the nicest people you could hope to meet. And he works responding to scenes of violent crimes to help the, he's a crisis response professional, responding to the scenes of violence, which exposes him to dangers, but exposes him to reliving and to some extent traumas. But now he's trying to help people not to go down the path that he did.
I think what you're explaining is he was successful in changing his mindset. He was successful in redefining his underlying schema and the thoughts that he has about himself. And that reminded me of a story. And this was not my client. This was one of my professors at the Chicago School. She told this story where she was doing IQ testing in a prison setting. And she did IQ testing with this one individual inmate, and he said nothing after the test. And she completed the test, and she looked up and she's like, oh, you're above average. And said nothing, didn't say anything, didn't do anything, just walked away. She was a little taken aback, like, oh, okay. And then come to find out, she came and had the opportunity to speak to him again. And he had flourished. He had graduated with his GED. He had entered a similar program to what was his name?
Michael.
To Michael. He had entered a similar program to Michael, and he was flourishing. And she had the cause to ask, what's going on here? Like, what was the change? And he told her, and it was so heartwarming / eye-opening, you were the first person to ever tell me that I was above average. It's ridiculous. That's amazing for that human, but ridiculous that that little change could have caused that cascade of positivity and changes for that person. And if that could happen for that one person, I am certain that it can happen for more.
You just have to wonder how many lives would be saved, how many communities would be improved, and how many, if people want to look at it crassly as just pure dollars and cents, as you made point, how much money would be saved for taxpayers if we simply identified problems and figured out rational ways, cost-effective ways of dealing with them. Now, that's what the Bright Star Community Outreach Program Agency does, it seems to me.
Yes.
Starting with a faith organization, And then thinking, how can we turn our faith principles into action in the community to make a difference? And everything that has unfolded since, to me, this is enormously impressive. But the BSCO agency did not act alone. They're partners.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of a greater Bronzeville community network. Can you speak to that?
Not as well as PCH, but for me, the Greater Bronzeville Network has informed our action. So we, instead of doing at or doing for, we are very focused on doing with. We know what we need, and we want to collaborate and conversate with the Greater Bronzeville area and understand what they also need. And that's what that network is for, to inform our action and to give us objectives and to give us goals. So they informed us they wanted this type of support. They informed us that they wanted mental health services. They informed us that they wanted workforce development because, and again, PCH will put this so much in a completely different light, I'm sure.
PCH being Pastor Chris Harris.
Correct. My apologies. I call him PCH.
A lot of people do.
And so, but you, to your point of respect, we can fix your brain and help you with CBT or other type of intervention. But once you're fixed, if you can't put food on the table or if you can't do for your family, you're right back to being unfixed. And so the TNT, the trauma and training, really go hand in hand in the TNT and CNC model so that we can help create and sustain the neighborhood rather than do at the neighborhood. And we do this as much as possible with the voices that inform us rather than at them.
Government solutions are usually directed at a mm-hmm. community, but the community itself working together and seeking the resources that they need is, you end up with organizations like your own that are working with a community as part right. of the community. Now, you mentioned a TNT and CNC.
Correct.
Okay, what's that?
TNT and CNC is trauma and training, and then community collaboration and conversation. So those are the four tenets of BSCO. So trauma is the behavioral health department focusing on being proactive, as well as if something happens, helping you in the present and then working towards a healthier future, destigmatizing mental health and encouraging people to seek the equitable services that they deserve. The other T is training, which is our workforce development department, and they work very diligently to provide different opportunities to train adults as well as anyone who wants to work towards entrepreneurship, as well as anything else that they may need so that they can go on and work and sustain themselves. And then the community collaboration and conversation that comes in with our development team, as well as our work with the GBCAC, the Greater Bronzeville Community Action Council, and the Greater Bronzeville network of people that I've mentioned that really inform our work.
I find that as I've already said, the work of the Bright Star Community Outreach Program, its people, its mission, and its impact is being inspiring. It's impressive, at the very least. But it seems to me that it's part of a story, the Bronzeville story, that is a model in many ways of how communities can take ownership of their own community, their own neighborhood, Bronzeville being a historic, culture-rich,
mm-hmm.
Identity-rich neighborhood of Chicago, for those who may not know,
mm-hmm.
and saying we are going to be masters of our own destiny in our community. We're going to rebuild, reform, reimagine, recreate Bronzeville. We may not be able to change the world, but we can change Bronzeville.
Well, if PCH has anything to do with it, we will replicate and help the world as much as we can. But absolutely, starting in Bronzeville, which is where PCH was born, where he grew up, and where he now works and does everything. So I think that he is very invested, and he has built teams that are very invested in, speaking only for myself and answering the question that you didn't ask, why am I here? I tell staff regularly when I'm hiring that they might be curious as to why I'm here. And I tell them the same thing over and over again. The work that we do bringing mental health services to people of color in any neighborhood, but especially in Bronzeville, is hard. We are working uphill most of the time because so many people still feel that stigma and still feel like they don't need the services. And I think that I provide a safe and appropriate environment for staff to provide those really hard services and then come back. And my due diligence is to create a behavioral health network, a behavioral health army, if you will, that will continue to grow and serve all the most marginalized of us. Without serving the most marginalized, we will not get stronger as a society. And I really believe that if we simply forget or try to forget, you know, adults with severe mental illness, people of color of lower socioeconomic class, vulnerable adults, children in general, if we continue to disservice them and not provide them with these services, where are we going to be? We're not going to give them everything that we have, and we're not going to create the best form of future that we can as a society. And so that's why I'm here. I know PCH is here so that he can continue to grow and multiply and create turn centers across the United States and the world. I'm starting here, and I'll keep growing with him as long as I'm allowed.
I'm going to flip back here. I was thinking of this question, and the conversation took a little different turn. You had mentioned that working with pastors in the community, mm-hmm. the faith community.
Yes.
So I'm in the faith community, in my words, not yours, is a kind of a feeder system into mm-hmm. the services provided here in the Turn Center. Are there other communities, schools, or other community organizations that feed people to the Turn Center?
Absolutely. A quick breakdown of our teams. So we have a care helpline. On purpose, we call it a helpline, not a crisis line, because we ask that you call if you've just simply had a bad day. We also ask that you call if you are in crisis. So we can help you anywhere in that continuum. We could also help you if you simply need some resources in the community or need help filling out your SNAP information. It really is a helpline, not necessarily just crisis. And it is a service line. So unlike other crisis lines, you do reach a trauma advocate that has been trained in trauma-informed care and person-first engagement. And the difference there is that you can continue services with that person that you reach. So it is by virtue telehealth as well. And moving on, we have our care team, our care and resilient environment room team. And those are physical rooms in schools in the Bronzeville area. And that is based on the model provided to us by CPS, social emotional learning. And just simply providing a safe space for people. And I say people because it's not just for students. We do, by and large, work mostly with students. We try and work with teachers and admin and literally anyone in the school family as well, because we have a very clear understanding that if you're a teacher and you had a bad day, you might bring that into the classroom and that can affect the learning. Or if you're a parent and you've had a bad day, that can affect your interactions with your child and how they learn that day. And so we try and serve the entire school family in that way. And providing that safe space has helped us to learn just how much the students in the three schools we're in need us and how much they deserve to have that safe space to talk about their feelings, because it does not seem from observation that they've had that space otherwise for whatever reason. And we recognize that CPS, they are there to teach our children, not necessarily to provide them with a behavioral health safety space.
CPS so, being the Chicago
Public Schools, correct. And it takes a village, and we're happy to be part of that village. And so that's our care room. And then in addition to that, we have our Family Advocacy Center, which is a model that we are granted from DCFS, Department of Child and Family Services here in Illinois. And we are able to serve 50% of our intakes come from, our referrals come from DCFS. So that's where all those referrals come from. But then 50% of our referrals can come from the community. And this is free clinical therapy. So we provide individual, we provide family therapy, we provide couples therapy. We also provide two different groups, anger management and parenting class. I'm encouraging staff to try other groups, but those are our two solid groups. And then last but certainly not least, are our ambassadors. And our ambassadors are community ambassadors. They are our engagement team that goes out into the community, and they actually inform the public and bring referrals in about our services. But they actually have three different things that they do. So they will go and inform the public at various events, and they will provide swag and bring referrals back into the department, but they will also actually do direct service. So if it happens that they're out in the community and they are working with a hospital system, or they're working with a old folks home, or they're working with a school system that has recently had some community violence nearby, we will reach out and we will ask, would you like some type of trauma-informed care series, meaning groups, so 5 to 10 weeks of a curriculum that we develop individually for those entities. For instance, right now we are serving at St. Bernard Hospital, which is the mental health hospital in District 2 here nearby, and we're providing a 8-week cohort style training, and have been doing so for the last year and a half, training all of their staff on de-escalation, trauma-informed care, and how to care for themselves. Because again, we recognize those staff are bringing what happens outside into the hospital, and that may cause struggle. That may cause issues with how they care for others or how they care for themselves. And so just trying to be more systemic with our engagements.
Well, this is taking a community approach.
Absolutely.
Changing behavior by changing the community's, well, the community environment, but mm-hmm. also community response to the sorts of things that would otherwise lead to crime and domestic violence or mm-hmm. mental health issues that you've prevented, behavioral health issues, other sorts of drug use, all these sorts of things. If you can head it off at the front end.
Absolutely.
Oh, the savings in terms of human costs, community costs, and financial costs, taxpayer costs are huge. Well, let's wrap up here. So if you were sitting down with somebody who really didn't know much about what you do and why you do it, how would you summarize that?
If somebody were in front of me and they asked me what I do, I always tell them that I listen to stories and that I teach people in my department and others how to listen to stories in a healthy way. And the reason I stipulate that is because it does take a toll on yourself when you're listening and when you're aiding and when you're helping with community trauma and personal trauma, but it's also incredibly gratifying to be able to help people re-identify themselves and identify that resilience that is inside of all of us. And so, yeah, I listen to stories and help people identify their resilience.
Powerful. Now, you mentioned a helpline. What is that number?
It's 833 TURN, T-U-R-N, 123.
Could you repeat that?
833 TURN, 123.
Now, also, there is a website, mm-hmm. brightstarcommunityoutreach.com.
Correct.
That's all one word.
All one word, all lowercase. Yep.
BrightStarCommunityOutreach.com. And I would encourage people to go to that. I think you'll see a model and approach to changing a community and changing lives in the community, working from the community up, not necessarily, I mean, certainly accessing resources that are available through the University of Chicago, Northwestern Hospital, and United Way, Chicago Public Schools, Chicago Police Department. In fact, I even understand from Pastor Harris that there are police officers who seek services.
Yes.
And because it's a very traumatizing profession. Absolutely. So, yes, it's not all community up. There are other resources that the community can tap. And this combination that is really community driven is what makes the other resources actually have the impact that they would hope to have. But without that, I think that it's pretty much at naught to be trying to change communities through government alone or any of these other sorts of things, acting alone.
Well, when we spoke earlier, it really does take a village, and government alone, education alone, mental health alone, physical health alone, those are all just different parts of the whole. And so we do really need to be unified in trying to help if we expect change.
Deanna, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you for joining us for this conversation. Is it possible to turn high-crime communities around? Yes. As Pastor Harris described in the previous episode, and Deanna Perez does in this episode. If you missed the episode with Pastor Harris, be sure to go back and listen to it. Your eyes will be opened. For more information about how to heal people and communities through the TURN model, go to BrightStarCommunityOutreach.com. That's BrightStarCommunityOutreach, all one word, .com, C-O-M. For more episodes of Justice Voices with eye-opening stories and perspectives, visit our website at justicevoices.org. That's justicevoices, all one word, .org. Share the link with friends, and be sure to like, follow, and subscribe to this program. This is Justice Voices, eye-opening stories that need to be told, voices that need to be heard regarding justice, healing, and safer communities.